Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable.
Hi, welcome everybody. We're live here at AccreditCon. So we have begun our online broadcast. We have some folks that have joined us, and my name is Dave Page. I am the director of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum at UCLA, and we are here with Michael Caduce, who is the principal investigator for this particular paper. So we're really excited that you were able to join us.
Absolutely. And what a better place to talk about program deficiencies in paramedic education than at the AccreditCon conference live with a live studio audience.
Amazing. So what's happening here in Oklahoma City, OKC, is we have folks getting lunch and then they're coming into the room. And as they come into the room, they'll begin to sit down. Dr. Megan Corey is going to lead us in this particular webinar, and she is just finishing her session on
advisory committees.
Yes. Excellent. The topic of the day is medical directors, facilities, and finances, resource deficiencies in accredited paramedic programs. While we are working on getting everybody in the room, I thought it would be a good idea to just let you know that all of our sessions are archived on YouTube. You can also subscribe to an RSS feed, which Stephanie Limmer has been teaching me all about, and we're really wanting you to connect through the RSS feed, because you can get your podcast through Spotify, through
iTunes. Yep, Apple's the Apple Podcast Store. You can get it on iHeartMedia.
Love it.
So anywhere you can get your
podcast. And you set all that up, which is really like this is the moment where I can be very grateful for all of the work that you do for PCRF as an associate, but also because you clearly have connected us to a digital world that we're not connected to before. So thank you.
Well, I appreciate that. The goal is that you can get this podcast anywhere you get your podcast. So whatever your podcast provider of choice is, we publish to all of them. And it only goes to show the great mentorship that we have had throughout the PCRF and the opportunity for us to continue to disseminate research to more and more people.
So we have like a really embarrassingly low number of subscribers on YouTube. So everybody in the room needs to log in to YouTube and subscribe to the PCRF podcast, just so that our metrics reflect the love that we have, the deep love for research that all of us in EMS have.
Similarly, if you're someone like me who does their podcast while they're driving and they get to listen, if you're not subscribed to us on, again, whatever your podcast of choice is, you can subscribe to us there. We do get all those metrics. We're thrilled to see after every time we publish a podcast, we get the download report and love seeing, we can tell where people are downloading it in terms of like their geographic, sort of like what state you're in. And we love to see the representation all across the US and across the world. We have, you know, all continents represented.
And here, so please amplify, rehash, retag. We really not only need it, we love it, and it will help, especially if you're an educator, since we're at AccreditCon, to get our students to actually be connected to this and see the activity as it happens. So I do want to take us to the abstract, the call for abstracts. It's an exciting year. I think we're going to break some records.
I think we're on track to do that.
It is really common for us to get, you know, somewhere around 75 abstracts for the International Scientific Symposium at EMS World Expo. Really a shout out to all of our partners, particularly EMS World, who makes it possible for us to have posters and oral presentations, and we have an entire track that's dedicated to research. So this year, it's in September in Las Vegas, and we're excited that the deadline for applications is June 30th. So submit your research please, 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 calling all research. If you've got research, come on in. Bring your research to the International Scientific Symposium. The deadline is June 30th. Now, if you were also thinking, well, but I was sort of thinking of submitting to NAMSP, we are very friendly with NAMSP and love that we can present it both because they're so close together, that it is a wonderful synergistic relationship so that more research can be seen by EMS providers, especially EMS World. And so you can submit to both, the same abstract can go to both.
I can attest to that. We've done that the last couple of years. And in fact, last year, our expo presentation was at NAMSP and got a poster. We were really happy to be, I think we were in the top 50 or something like that, but you can do it. It's possible. And you make the poster once, you put all the effort into making that poster, the opportunity to share your work at multiple conferences or at least two conferences, and to get to talk to people, answer questions about your research as you're thinking about turning it into a manuscript. Those questions are incredibly helpful as you design that research. So I am glad to hear that there are some people that are on the ball. And despite the fact we have another month to submit them, have already submitted. If there's the researchers out there like me, we'll be submitting on January 29th or January 30th or June 30th or June 29th.
I resemble that remark, the deadline remark.
That's the day mine will be submitted. So we're excited to have a couple projects underway, but I appreciate the researchers that already have their posters and abstracts ready to go.
Please come on in, have a seat as people grab their lunch and join us. We'll get going with the subject matter at hand. A couple of other things about the International Scientific Symposium. First of all, $500 cash prize for the winner of Best Research. And we have both winner. Yes, yes. Raise your eyebrows. That's right. Marquita, we want your research. You're putting a research project in. Just repeat after me. So so what we have also is up to $2,000 in travel stipend for reimbursement of travel to present this at an international venue. So we have relationships with Australia, with Europe, with Asia, and we'll see researchers from Asia present their projects, as well as our researchers go to, let's see, Remley went to Madrid, yeah. Dr. Crow went to Madrid, Dr. Wampler has gone to Glasgow and to Brisbane. So really want to get the world to see the quality of the research that EMS providers do in the US. And so we're willing to help fund that. And that's really thanks to all of our sponsors, like Limmer, who Stephanie's in the room, so I can thank her personally today instead of just virtually, all the support that we get and love we get to get this podcast to be able to happen twice a month. So please tune in. All right. So that's the awards. This year also with NAMT, and I know you're on the board, so we got to make sure we talk about this. NAMT gives us a chance to put two projects. It could be the same person if they have two projects, but the two best trauma research projects go to World Trauma Symposium at EMS World Expo in addition. So if you have the best research in trauma, then it gets ranked, it gets the points, and those go to get presented at World Trauma Symposium. There's about 500 people in that room, plus
leading
online.
Experts on trauma.
And online. So you get a little more bang for your buck. If it's a research project that's trauma, you can also be able to present in that venue.
Really escalates the nature of the conference where we've got physicians who are doing the leading edge, cutting edge research on trauma, and you're up there presenting your research alongside.
Yeah, and the connection to the American College of Surgeons and their committee on trauma, it really, last year they were sort of impressed that there was that level of research, and we really like to promote that. So lots happening there in September. I also really just want to give a shout out. We have some incredible workshops coming up. I don't know why, but it's like the year of the workshop. So we have our traditional workshops that we do with ESO, Dr. Crow, Dr. Fernandez, amazing at organizing these things, are on our board, Dr. Bourne. So we do these kind of speed dating type workshops where you show up with an idea and turn it into a project. And we don't charge anything. The sponsor helps us fund the event, feed everybody that's there. But the cool thing is that in our partnership with ESO, they have a connection to outcome data. So we can actually do projects. You've done them and published with them. And in fact, have a new, do you want to, can you talk about the one that just got published or?
That's not published yet. So we're in the works. It's we're in the peer review process. So how about when we get it published, we'll come back and do another podcast on it. But I can attest, we presented at NAMSP last time, our project on chest pain patients and do they all necessarily need to end up in an emergency department or would alternate transportation? Really, the first time I talked to a medical director who was not at the conference, they said, was there a medical director in the room when you were doing this? Because this is like, you're telling me that not every chest pain patient in the hospital, like that EMS arrives on needs to go to the hospital. I think intuitively, we know the 18-year-old is probably not having a heart attack, right? But to get up in front of people and say, no, actually, we think there's some criteria that if the patient matches, they'd be great to follow up with their family care doctor or with urgent care. They probably don't need to sit in an emergency department. And we turn some heads. So that's the type of research that's coming out of these research workshops where you're really getting to ask yourself some pretty innovative questions. And it's not just me and like the ideas in my head and the voices in my head that go back and forth debating these questions. You've got, you know, physicians and EMS board certified physicians who know what you should be looking at and can kind of help guide the questions. But then a statistician and a methodologist that's there with you as well saying, here's how we can actually look at that to answer that question. It's not just here's the data you have. What can you pull from it? It's truly what question do you have? And then let's figure out how we can address that question specifically.
What's really cool, so for those of you who have some gray hair, that I see some in the room, we know that it's been hard to get outcomes. So the problem with doing any kind of research is the fact that we have very limited knowledge about what our carrier really actually does. So ESO connected their service bridge to a health bridge to get outcomes from the hospitals. And these workshops allow us to find out what really happened to the patient and the outcome of the patient, which permit us to know if the care we provided was really actually worth it. So that connection so that providers could know outcomes is actually an enormous benefit. And I know you've done projects around that with that. So if you're thinking, you know, well, we never find out what happened, it's a new day in EMS research and we should really take advantage of this. I'm hoping the educators actually that are tuned in would do a project where we can find out if the level of education or the type of education actually resulted in a improvement in patient outcome. So not just connecting patient care from once they graduated, but actually what happens in the process. But one of the amazing things that we're doing is with these workshops, because there's so many workshops that NHTSA is going to help us with a workshop coming up in November in Utah. So stay tuned, come to prehospitalcare.org on the website. We want to have people participate. That'll be focused on trauma and post-crash care. But it really has taken off. We're doing one with Weinman focused on ventilation and airway. And the next one will be in February of 2025 in Milwaukee with Dr. Ofterheide. So that workshop is well underway. We just finished an equity one with CareStar. So what's exciting is to see so many new researchers diving into the research. Don't go away, Megan Corey, because we are definitely, we're not tap dancing, but we are tap dancing.
Though it's the year of research workshops, but how, or what a monumental moment for us in EMS to, I think, just take a pause to say there are more people interested in doing EMS research today than ever before. And if you know, I don't know how many subscribers the PCRF podcast had in its first year, but now we probably have more workshops with people attending to do research than probably some of our first podcasts. And I think worth recognizing the great work of you and the research associates for the PCRF in general to inspire people to recognize that in healthcare, we do research and EMS is healthcare. And thus we should be doing EMS research.
Love it. So we are ready for you. We're just going to start talking about medical directors, facilities, and finances.
Cool.
And you have a whole lot of folks online, some people in the room. So take it away, Megan.
Yeah, and we might have some guest appearances because we do have Dr. Michael Miller here. We do have Dr. Ash Panchal here, and we can't see you, Michael.
I keep moving out of frame.
For anybody who's watching out there, first of all, thank you for the people who came in with their, don't forget to get lunch. If you didn't get lunch, I'm seeing people without lunch. And thanks for joining us. And I am really excited about this. I just came from a session where we talked about advisory committees, and we talked about input, and we talked about the resource assessment. And it's very cool. First, I want to take a minute and say it's great to be in Oklahoma City and live at a CreditCon. And next year, we're going to be in Anaheim at a CreditCon too, which is great. And this is a great place to discuss this research because all these wonderful people who work for paramedic programs and you program directors out there, I just want to say first before we dig in, thank you for sending out these surveys. And if you're looking at them going, oh, I don't know if I got the best data out of it or whatever, well, now you're going to hear why it's great to get this kind of data. We all collect the same thing because we are mandated to use this form, and this is why we get this level of detail. So let's dig in. So, and Michael, you are the principal author here.
Absolutely. And as we dive into it, a shout out to the National Registry and COA, because those are our author teams that work to put this all together. The only reason we can evaluate this data is because of a partnership between COA and National Registry that allowed us to do some data sharing and what led to the data analysis that we did for this paper.
Great. So I'm just forwarding, excuse me, a slide. You guys can't see this because we didn't do a you know, presenting, which we'll think about in the future. But you might see in the background a window washer going by us in a second.
Windows. Yeah, they're watching. Like they're coming through the windows.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me what even led you to this to begin with? Why did you even begin on this journey?
Great question. So I actually had reached out back shortly after about 2021. I'd reached out to the National Registry saying we wanted to do some program specific analysis of COVID data. And the National Registry allows you to do this. You can reach out to the National Registry and do a data request. There's a process and they review it. And they had sent me a letter that said, we're not sure this is possible, but can we meet and talk about it? And so I said, sure. And there's some really important people in this meeting and me who's like never done this scale of research. And they said, the project you're looking at, don't think is possible with the data that we have. But Dr. Panchal said, you know, would you be interested in doing this other project? Because we have the data, but we don't have anyone to sort of spearhead it and to do the data analysis or the thematic analysis, which is what we ended up doing. Would you be interested? And I said, oh, do research on this scale, on this level? Absolutely. I'm just not experienced with it. So I'll need some help. And they said, absolutely, we'd love to. So working with Chris Gage and Jonathan Powell, the research associates, to start diving into this research and really looking at what it means and then going through the publishing process and the peer review process was really unique. And I can't say enough good things about them being along for the process and sort of being like, no, this is okay. This is where we're going. Yeah. This is what we're going to get to. So that's what started it. Before that, familiar with the RAM, having done it at the program that I was running in Iowa. But until then, not really looking at the data. So that's really what sort of so this partnership got us going. Mm-hmm. Now we have all this data. So we have all this RAM data, all the resource assessment matrices that all of our paramedic program providers get back. Right. You stratify all your data from your surveys, you put it into a table, you submit it to COA. COA takes all 626 paramedic programs and has all that data. Up until the point where we started to do this research, nobody ever looked at it in a sort of quantified it all together. Right? It had been looked at by programs and programs specifically, but never as a whole. And so we started to ask the question of, is the resource assessment matrix telling us anything about program performance? Mm-hmm. In the world of workforce shortages and attrition and students and EMTs and paramedics leaving the field, is there something here that we could do to improve how many students are staying in the field, whether it's initial education or in the field of EMS? Yeah. So that's really what got us started. We had the data. We know there's these problems. Is there something that this data can tell us so that we can improve performance of paramedic programs?
And if you're not familiar with the RAM, the resource assessment is a tool that paramedic program directors send out to two separate groups. One is students really at or near, actually, this is the resource assessment is at or near completion. So that's usually that group. I was thinking graduate survey, but that's later. Different than the graduate survey. And then the resource assessment for personnel goes to program personnel, and that includes your advisory committee too. So, and the resource assessment survey goes through several items, yep. And you've grouped them really nicely in this study.
Absolutely. So the RAM, we said it goes to all the stakeholders in the program, right? So I think that includes students. That also includes your faculty. So we thought this is a great 360 evaluation, if you will, of the program. And when you can see it, when you take the RAM, it's broken up into 10 different categories, right? Things like finance, things like curriculum, field internship, clinical internship, all of the different things that sort of make up the program. And since it's the survey is in 10 categories, most people don't probably pay attention to those 10 mm-hmm. categories when they're filling it out, but the RAM is already broken up into certain categories. So that's what started our survey and led into our methods.
Yeah. And you know, this actually follows up on something we talked about last year at AccreditCon. Last year, we talked about the administrative and characteristics and educational characteristics of paramedic programs across the country. And we pulled from, you know, the accreditation data. This is a very specific look. So now we're looking at what kind of resources are these programs, you know, dealing with resource crises that they're dealing with, basically. Absolutely. So can you walk us through the methodology, or actually there's the table. Usually you see those of you who are looking at the screen, what we see is basically the table that takes you from how you got your population to what population you're actually looking at here.
Exactly. So as part of, so any paramedic program, after they complete their RAM, important to note that if you have an 80% positive response to a category, you don't have to do anything. It's not a deficiency. If you have more than a 20% negative response, students saying they didn't have enough time in the classroom, advisory council members saying the medical director is not involved enough, for example, then as a program director, you have to note that and provide a comment and an action plan. So the comment might be something like an explanation of why they think this is the case. The associated action plan is what they think should come out of it. Mm-hmm. So we took all of this data and then started to evaluate. I think it's worth recognizing every program is required to do the RAM.
Yeah.
So this is an inclusive survey that looked at all 626 paramedic programs that graduated a cohort in the year of 2018.
Yeah.
It's important to recognize we went back to 2018 because you have to allow for a full certification cycle. So
right.
Paramedic graduates in 2018. They have until 2020 to actually certify as a paramedic. So you can't look at that data until 2020. In 2021 is when we started to look at this data. It also helps us stratify a little bit for COVID. So it gets us out of all of the deficiencies that could have happened because you overnight had to move your program online.
Yeah, that was really great. So now you have this pool of data that is kind of free from all of that,
absolutely.
Which I thought was a really good idea.
Absolutely. So we have all 626 programs, and we looked at how many of these programs had reported at least one deficiency. And what we found were there were 143 programs that reported at least one deficiency. Now, again, programs can have up to 10 deficiencies. And we found that there were some programs that were reporting 10 deficiencies. So a deficiency in every category. There were a total of 406 deficiencies, again, representing 143 programs. So some programs had more than one, up to 10. The most common deficiency was one single deficiency of those 10 categories.
So most your programs that had a deficiency had one.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Now, the meat and potatoes, if you will, of this study was to then go look at all of those comments left by program directors. So there were 406 comments left by program directors and 406 associated action plans in these 10 categories. So then we went and did a thematic analysis of those. We did a deductive thematic analysis, which means we look at previous RAMs and comments that are made to try and come up with some categories that prevents you from biasing yourself towards the future categories. You then theme them. So if we see a consistency in the medical director category, which is what we will end up seeing, is there was a lack of involvement. So the theme is lack of involvement, but recognizing not all the program directors wrote, we have a lack of involvement from our paramedic program director. There were a lot of different comments. So then we had to work to try and figure out, okay, what are they saying here? Another very common one was the room's too hot or the room's too cold.
Oh, we're going to talk about that.
Right. So then it was our job to say, we can't have 80 categories. We can't have, you know, two programs say it's too hot, four programs say it's too cold, and three programs say there's not enough space. So we had to theme those out. So environmental, right? Too hot or too cold, room temperature was a theme that came through. And there were several comments that went into that. So we themed both the comments and we themed the action plans.
Wow, great.
And then the reason we like the deductive thematic analysis is because then we can quantify it. Mm-hmm. So we can say, okay, this many programs had too hot or too cold. This many programs, so their medical director was not involved enough. So the thematic analysis allows us to take this comment, this qualitative data, and make it a number.
Yeah.
And so we quantified it, if you will. And then that gives us something to evaluate for to describe the deficiencies in paramedic programs.
Yeah, and that's what we're looking for. We're looking for patterns, right? What's a common theme among paramedic programs so that now we can actually talk about what comes, you know, after that. And we'll get to that. Let's look first at just like anything else in research, you want to look at, you know, the demographics and some of the characteristics of the program. So take us through this table about demographics.
Absolutely. So we wanted to describe the programs to the best of our ability, thinking that there might be something there. And I think if you sort of walk in, you know, does this research pass my sniff test, right? So my initial sniff test would be like, the programs that have the most cohorts and the most students probably have the most resources, or at least maybe hopefully have the most money, so thus they can have the most resources. That was not the case, but that's where we started in looking at size of program, thinking there might be something there, and number of cohorts. So if you graduate one cohort a year, that's a lot different than if you're graduating 15 cohorts a year. So we did look at that, and we can talk about it when we get to the discussion, really how we stratified for it. But we looked at that. We also looked at what the NSIMSO regions, to see if there was a discrepancy between regions that was having more deficiencies or less deficiencies. And we looked at the annual program budget. The helpful part there is the budget's reported to COA as well. So again, standardized data across the board. We didn't have to go to your website and figure out what your operating budget was. That would be nearly impossible.
Because I was going to ask you about that. I was going to say, no. So first of all, why would we care? Why do we care about things like this? Why do we care about, you know, graduating cohort numbers and regions and money?
I think there's a common assumption out there that the more money you have, the less likely you are to have deficiencies.
Yeah.
Right. I think if you ask me, you know, if we have a $10 million endowment versus $100,000 endowment, is there a benefit there? Mm-hmm. I think the rational person would say, absolutely. You have a ton more resources because you have a ton more money. So we thought that was important to look at. And table one sort of stratifies that. Again, there's not a ton of programs in that huge operating budget. Most of the programs have an operating budget of less than $500,000. Mm-hmm. So I think worth recognizing it's not as stratified as we might think it is. Mm-hmm. It's easy to think that some of these programs have huge operating budgets. And it probably doesn't shock the program directors that are out there that like our budgets are not that big.
Okay, so let's dig into what we found in the RAM deficiency category.
Absolutely. So when we look at just each deficiency and the number of deficiencies per those 10 categories that COA has already analyzed, we see some commonality. The number one category with the most deficiencies is medical director, then facilities, and the third is financial resources. So looking out at the room and looking at the, you know, the folks that are out there, does that pass our test? Is your medical director active in your program, and not just active that they come and sign the paperwork for you when you ask them to come and sign your paperwork, but are they in the classroom? Could your mm-hmm. students know their name, or God forbid, pick them out of a crowd if they had to? Those are the questions that we started asking, because that's where this data is driving us. And the most common deficiency was medical directors are not involved in the program. And that, again, is noted by students because they're the majority of those taking the RAM survey. So again, I think sometimes I have to take my program director hat off and put my educator hat on and say, our program director sees our medical director all the time, because they're in there signing the paperwork. But do they ever interact with the students? Is there a terminal competency? Lots of programs do that. Are they doing a lecture? Where are my students seeing my medical director? Or are they a medical director by paper?
So I'm going to ask you to take off the program director hat and the other hat that you mentioned and put on your researcher hat for a second. And tell me, would there be value in looking at maybe students versus program personnel and determining resource? Or did you think about that part at all? Or
I think that would be really interesting data. The data doesn't get reported like that.
Yeah.
I think also when you look at just the sample size, right, the majority of, there's a lot less faculty per student. So you're getting that. I think it'd also be interesting to see what your advisory council thinks of your program.
Thank you for mentioning that.
Now, I would say program directors, you do have access to that information.
Yes.
Because when you're at the advisory council and you give the RAM survey out, you collect it back in.
Yes.
There's nothing that says you individually couldn't look at that data.
Mm-hmm.
The data doesn't get reported as stratified with that. Now, I will say, looking at these results, the sort of really interesting to see that overall, things like learning resources and curriculum meet the student expectations, right? Or at least we don't see the deficiencies there. So something's happening in the classroom that the students, you know, for the most part, are pretty happy with.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because there's a whole bunch to this survey. So that means there's a whole lot of items that are meeting the expectations of the student. Let me see. We've got somebody in the chat.
While we look at that, I think the other thing to note is physician interaction was number 5 and medical directors was number 1. So what we're seeing is, despite the fact that EMS providers work under a physician, right, the Delegated Medical Authority Act is really important in EMS.
Yeah.
The programs are not seeing that. So 2 of the top 5 deficiencies are physician involvement in the field clinical setting and lack of involvement in the classroom and the program director. That was a result that we thought was pretty significant, and that we need to go back and start evaluating why that's the case and what we can do to work on it.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Michael Miller is in and out of this room. And when he comes back, one of the things that we want to point out too is we don't really have a standard for what is, you know, valuable physician involvement. Does the student have to, they need to know who their medical director is, but, some people feel like, I've seen programs say, I have to have them lecture. There isn't a standard that says your physician has to lecture. They do have to sign off on terminal competency. So there has to be some degree of confidence that each student is competent. So
I would add to it, there's no set threshold for how many deficiencies is appropriate or not appropriate, right? Yeah. If you have a deficiency, you have to create an action plan, but nobody's saying one deficiency is bad or 2 deficiencies are bad, or if you have 3 deficiencies or more, something is wrong, right? Now, I think if you're looking at your data and you're seeing we have lots of deficiencies as a good involved program director, you're probably thinking that, mm-hmm. but there's no set standard on how many deficiencies is appropriate or adequate, or is it based on how long your program's been around or how long your program director's been involved. So I think worth noting, there's not a standard per se.
Yeah, that's a good point. So let's dig into I think you have more detail on each one in terms of, and this is a rough table to see.
Absolutely. So
on the screen,
this is table 3, and this is the thematic analysis. So these are the comments. So once we themed all of the comments for each one of the categories, this is where we started to see some things. So I think worth noting again, medical director involvement was the top deficiency. And what we primarily saw, or 91% of it, was limited interaction with the program or the students. And again, as a program director, maybe that's mind-blowing to some program directors. To others, it's probably not. Yeah. So I think worth evaluating it, but you're in a similar boat there. Then when we get to facilities, because again, for medical directors, almost all of them were a lack of involvement in the program. When we get to facilities, we get a little bit more distribution. Here we saw a lot of comments around lack of classroom space or equipment and lack of lab time or equipment. So depending on how the program director wrote the comment was how we could theme it. So you saw a lot of people saying not enough physical classroom space, not enough mannequins, right? I think we could argue that there's a big difference between not enough mannequins and not enough laryngoscopes, right? One's pretty easy and is a disposable, and one's a substantial capital improvement. The themes were not, or the comments were not that specific. So if you had a lack of equipment, you were in the lack of equipment. If you were in the lack of classroom space, we could sort of stratify for lab space versus classroom space. But for the most part, if you didn't have enough equipment, this is where it fell. Hard to tell what type of equipment that necessarily was. I do think because we brought it up earlier, temperature management was in here. So 19% of the deficiencies in facilities were noted to be, it was either too hot or too cold in the classroom, which I think is ironic because there's the research from the 50s has been around saying if it's too hot or too cold, people don't learn well. And actually it looks like Dr. Miller is jumping in.
I just want to say for a minute, first of all, Dr. Ash Panchal is in the room. Thank you for your research and, join in if you'd like. And Dr. Kim McKenna is here, who's one of our phenomenal PCRF folks too. I really appreciated the detail on that. And I really appreciated the detail on the temperature management part, especially that you had links to studies that showed if the temperature of the room isn't right, people can't learn. And I think personally, I learned that because we're one of those programs that had a broken boiler over COVID in all of our buildings. And we came back and it was like a meat locker downstairs. And I said, how can they study? Now I have an article that I can parade and say, what are we doing about this?
Ironically, some of the comments in this specific area were, we're doing the classroom in an ambulance garage or an ambulance bay. Yeah. So it's whatever the ambient temperature outside is, we don't have a lot of control over that. A couple other comments were, our programs are on the weekends and our college doesn't pay for the ventilation settings are different on the weekends, so we save energy. To me, that seems like a really easy solution, right? Like, someone's in control of the thermostat. How do you figure it out? Now we have the research that says, go to your programs and say, we have a deficiency here, and we're one of very few programs that can't control our own core temperature in the classrooms. Yeah. We should fix that.
Yeah.
Dr. Miller, what are your thoughts?
Well, I heard from my colleague, Dave Page, that there was a question about standards related to physician medical directors.
What meets the standard for?
Yeah.
We talked about signing the terminal competency form, which exactly. You wouldn't assume means there's some interaction, but is there any more detail to that?
Right. There's a lot of really important things that we want the medical directors to be involved with. And it doesn't necessarily have to equate to a physician being in the classroom teaching for 3 hours or 4 hours every week. But we do want them to be engaged. And we know, although there's some research and not a lot of research on this, anecdotally, programs that have really, really strong medical directors who are engaged in the process, that are working collaboratively with the program director, have a foundation that sets the program up for success. You want the medical director to be that medical authority that's reviewing your curriculum, that is looking at it from an evidence-based standard perspective. Paramedics are going to have to interact and work under physicians in medical oversight after they graduate. It's important that they have some interaction and exposure to that. Experience before they graduate and they're done. We want them to be involved with corrective measures or remediation plans for students when perhaps they're not progressing very well. They should be apprised throughout the program and the educational experience of the students on how each and every individual student is progressing throughout their educational program. Give them periodic reports. It doesn't even have to be in person always. It could be grade reports. It could be by exception where the medical director is informed about potential students that might be at risk. Those are really important aspects for the medical director to be apprised of on a regular, consistent basis. They should be looking at examinations in the assessment process, the development and the design of the scenarios to make sure that they're medically accurate and have realistic expectations for the students. They may even have very specific thoughts on what types of scenarios they want every single student to have experienced in order to be able to graduate from the educational program. So again, they're teed up for success when they transition from the classroom to the world of work.
Yeah. And I know that it's not the next most frequent, but it's also mentioned in here, and that's physician interaction. So physician interaction can be anything from being in the hospital and interacting with physicians, being taught by physicians.
Oftentimes, there's a number of ways. And I would also encourage programs that if you are in certain areas where you have access to academic institutions that have EMS fellowship programs, there are nearly 100 of them, if not more, across the country, where you have emergency trained physicians that are looking for opportunities to explore and learn more about all facets of EMS, including paramedic education. So there are resources out there if you ask and you go looking for them, and maybe it's even just medical students or residents that are doing an emergency medicine residency program that you can tap into to get them involved and excited about what we do from a paramedicine perspective. There's a lot of ways to get them involved. Sometimes it's not necessarily presenting new content to students, but perhaps there's an opportunity for there to be case studies or a discussion of the types of patients that the students are actually encountering during their patient care experiences that can be presented and facilitated by the medical director about what was done for that patient or not done and how they could have potentially approached that differently in the future. We used to call these in my day run critiques. Physicians may commonly refer to these as M&M, morbidity or mortality committee meetings and those kinds of things. That's, I think, a really good way to leverage the medical director. bringing them in for psychomotor examinations, for them to directly observe the performance of students in applying what they're learning, is another way that you could leverage their expertise.
Some EMS systems I know have mobile units with base physicians going out on them. So there's another interaction with physicians. Yeah. Yeah. So that was another related one, I thought. Great. So curious, and let me just see if we got something in the chat here. I'm doing multitasking here.
I think one of the other things while we're looking at that is that the third common one was financial resources. Mm-hmm. And I would have thought, for what I hear from program directors, that it's the money. And that was that's obviously one of the big problems. And though it came up third. So I thought that was interesting. A couple of the themes that we saw specific to this one were, again, this lack of equipment thing shows up. And the reason we see this show up in multiple categories is because it's noted as a deficiency in those categories. So the comment made by the program director under financial resources was lack of equipment. It can be made in multiple places. This is where we saw it again. So this lack of equipment and lack of space continues to sort of come through multiple categories. We also saw a lack of faculty come through in the comments. And one that I thought was interesting was lack of scholarship or financial aid. The comments were a little bit difficult to delineate over. There's no financial aid or scholarship, or the students can't find it. We themed them the same because of how the comments were worded. It was difficult to tell what the difference was. But I think, again, as a program director, that may be one of those low-hanging fruits that I can fix. We saw in some of the action plans as great ideas for programs of, we now have the financial, like we take the students to the financial aid office when they do their tour, right? Mm-hmm. When they come and visit our program, we take them by the financial aid office and make the introduction, provide the card. So now the student has that contact. Or we have the financial aid office on site 1 hour a week so that students can meet with the financial aid office. To me, doesn't seem like something that should be so difficult, and that we have to have meetings. And though working in academic, everything has meetings, so maybe it does. But to me, that's one of those low hanging fruit things that seems we could sort of check that one off the list and raise that one.
Yeah, except for one thing too, I know people are dealing with, and that's the Title IV. Are you thinking the same thing?
Yeah,
the gainful employment issue. Anybody, if you haven't been dealing with this, you will. The gainful employment issue of Pell eligible students, students who are typically are Pell eligible for federal financial aid. The gainful employment federal rules, whatever you want to call them, are now, there's a proposal to, or there's actually movement to limit whether or not you're eligible for this financial aid based upon minimum hours. If, say, your state has a minimum set of hours and your program goes above that, making the students not being eligible to receive, it goes against everything that I can think of. These are the people who need it the most, the support the most, to get into and through paramedic programs. And I know states are dealing with this as well, how to process that. So
Megan, I was just going to say that some of the challenges are that oftentimes, unless there are workforce development dollars that are accessible, mm-hmm. oftentimes some of these students are not going to qualify for various types of scholarship funding or free federal government sponsored grants because they're not registered for their academic credits as degree seeking students. They're certificate of completion students.
That's right.
And that can create challenges for them to access those resources.
That's a really good point too, because gainful employment in the past, if you had a program that was over what was considered too many units, mm-hmm. And your state, and was interpreting that we can't have this program, or these students can't be eligible for federal financial aid, which happened to one of our college programs, not ours. It was because they could get around it by having an AS degree track, and they didn't have it. Whereas if you had an AS degree track, and even if they weren't in that entire track, they could still be eligible for federal financial aid. So that's actually becoming, this is a big issue that's right down the pipeline.
Yeah. And one thing that I think is exciting to share in, Dr. Ponchal mentioned this during his talk, there are other professions that are gaining access to large millions of dollars, sums of money to help fund various things from a health sciences profession perspective. I do want to give a shout out to a number of states that I'm aware of. I won't name them here because I'll inevitably forget somebody, but there are a number of states that have found access through their local legislatures at the state level, millions of dollars to fund free access to EMS education at all levels for their particular states. Yeah. And it's not insignificant. And that is largely happening because of workforce shortages. And they're trying to address it by making it accessible education by providing monies to support students that otherwise would not potentially have access to that. The other types of programs that we're seeing are apprenticeship style programs, where it's not only the tuition, but it's the financial support for gas in the car, groceries, and help paying their rent while they are focused on becoming a full-time student to be successful.
Yeah, great.
I think I would add one more thing in that recognizing we have issues in acquiring the financial aid, we have to still, as program directors, make sure that our students have access to the office, right? And that's what came through in the comments. Some of it was, we don't have the scholarship or the financial aid. And some of it was, we don't even know, our students are saying they don't even know where to look, or the students are specifically saying, we don't know where to look for this. So mm-hmm. I think it's an opportunity for us as program directors to go back and say, does the financial aid know, office know we're here? And where do we go from there? Yeah. Then we can figure out how do we get the federal financial aid dollars, the state financial aid dollars. But we have to make sure there's a connection there, because this is the only way you solve a workforce shortage.
Yeah, I've seen programs do something in their first week of class that I adopted, and I thought it was really helpful. And that was doing, what would you call it, a treasure hunt, or you give the students some kind of go upstairs, take a selfie with the financial aid officer, yep. you know, and they'd have this little thing where they'd go through. That way they'd know where
yep.
things
go
were
and what was
available.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And have financial aid presentations available, exactly. scholarship presentations, that kind of thing.
And even things yeah. like a scholarship page on your website, right? There are some national yeah. scholarships that are out there for EMS providers. Having a link to those, because most of them are open sort of mm-hmm. continuously, I think there's opportunity there for students as well who maybe wouldn't have thought that, you know, Tylenol offers a scholarship for medical students.
Absolutely.
and healthcare yeah. students.
Absolutely.
VNA EMT has scholarships too. So it just knowing that those are out there and having that as a website somewhere is incredibly helpful.
Can you put on your research hat just for a second again too? So when we look at table three and we see financial resources, what we're seeing in order is the, you know, the number one was lack of equipment and lack of faculty. And or lack of faculty,
yep.
Which I thought was interesting. That was under financial resources, but it comes up again under one of the others, I think.
Yep. There's a specifically
yeah, program
faculty category
yeah.
Where we also see lack of inadequate faculty or faculty communication. Again, the comments make it a little bit difficult to stratify what they were truly getting at. So we have to theme it somehow. And this is the best way to do it. But yeah, I would say the same thing. You saw lack of equipment show up in a few different categories.
Yeah.
Wherever the person filling out the RAM survey put it is where it got categorized. And that's where we themed it.
Yeah. So, and then lack of understanding of the question.
We did see that in a few different categories where we saw program directors saying, I'm not sure the students are understanding this question, or it could also be your advisory committee members are not understanding this question on the RAM. This is why COED was involved in the research. And it's my understanding that we've actually adopted some questions or added some questions to help understand a few of the nuances that came out. The results, maybe not this specific paper, but of the results of the RAM.
Because there's an NA category. They can click yes. not applicable if it doesn't apply to them. An advisory committee member may have never been to your simulation lab, so they may not, they've just put NA usually.
Yes, absolutely. And all of these are areas that are ripe for additional exploration, right?
Yeah.
And so there's an opportunity here to continue to pursue some of these and drill down even further. The most recent annual report that was just submitted did attempt to look at and explore some of those questions around the medical director involvement, as well as the program director and whether or not they feel supported in their role. We know that financial resources to support those positions is also oftentimes a question. So we are working to try to examine those more fully.
I'm so excited about this because, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but medical director, when you hear medical director in some other areas, especially like at NAEMSP, they're in medical director, it's focused on post-license. You know, you have, it's focused on, you know, I run an organization of, you know, an ambulance agency or a fire service or whatever, not the pre-licensure, the preparation, the initial education. So I'm really happy to see this. And we have Dr. Dorsett, who's presenting on medical direction at this AccreditCon. I mean, we need to build AccreditCon. We'll build on the data that you're providing and sending into this in research like this.
And I think it goes to your initial comment, Megan, which is this is the value of sending in your RAM survey.
Yes.
I can attest it seems monotonous to send. You got this survey 2 weeks ago. We haven't gotten it back yet. Yeah. We'd love to get it back from you. This is what that data collection can lead us to. And this is perhaps the first step of many that will continue to look at that as we refine this process and really start to say, okay, what are programs telling us?
Yeah. And your advisory committee, you mentioned that before, you know, getting this data in and they discuss it with their advisory committee, hear from the employers and others about, you know, the resources in the program.
Yep. Absolutely.
So this would be actually good to share with your advisory committee, this article. See, how do I compare? How do we compare to this? And you know, this is the common struggle.
Especially for programs that want to celebrate. Maybe we only have one or two deficiencies. Great. You're in this category. There are programs that are not doing that well. And if you have no deficiencies, great. Celebrate that as well. But to me, I agree with you. This is an opportunity for us to help educate those that are filling out the RAM of the value of it. Probably more so on the advisory side. Even faculty, there's value in what you say.
Sure.
And there's value in taking it back to the people that have the checkbooks at your colleges and universities and institutions. To say that we have two or three deficiencies. Yeah, the reason we're asking for the building, the thermostat, the equipment is because we're in this category. Yeah. And we did do some data stratification based on these programs and found that programs that had more deficiencies had a lower completion rate. So again, taking that back to the people with the money and saying, if we could get the funding and we could get what we need, the data is there to say that we can improve our process.
It's a really important point.
Yeah. In the tool, really, this whole resource assessment survey process and doing the RAM on an annual basis is designed by its very nature to be a continuous quality improvement process. It's not designed to be punitive. Yes, we require programs to do it. KHEP requires it as an accreditation standard. But it's intended to be a reflective process so that the program can evaluate and decide how they can potentially improve the education delivery that they're providing to students.
Very exciting stuff. So tell us what the action plans, what were people doing
Absolutely.
About it? I think it's so cool that you looked at this. So, I mean, you could have just sort of left it at that and that was enough. But instead of just saying, well, these are the problems, which we always hear, what are program directors doing about
it? Yeah, I figured we should look at 406 more comments. So we looked at the action plans as well. And I think the big takeaways I found on the action plans, and these come through in the themes. In fact, you can see it on the first couple of comments for medical director. One of them is seek to hire a new medical director. And another is seek to hire an assistant medical director. Great. We're seeking to do it. And then continue to monitor. And continue to monitor fell into a lot of action plans.
Yeah.
Which, okay, fine. I think my action driven would be like, okay, maybe we need to have time to have the conversation.
Yeah.
Right. We need to have, it's very possible that your medical director doesn't understand the expectation at which you need them to be involved in your program. Many of our medical directors wear many hats. And so trying to make sure that they know what their accountability is and evaluating, do you have the time to do that? Right. Is there financial compensation involved? And if so, this is what it's tied to. And if you can't meet that, that's okay. We need to either hire someone who can or add to an assistant medical director, things like that. I think a couple other things that came through in the facilities and the financial resources, again, this continue to monitor thing sort of drove me a little bit crazy. And they're like, aren't you striving to do something? But moreover, we saw places that said, we are building a new building. And we saw comments that were thinking about or were asking to build a new building. And to me, that was delineated in several of the different categories where we are actively doing it or we are talking about doing it.
Yeah.
And you have to talk before action happens. We're not just, no one's going to come to you with a checkbook and say, oh, you want to build a new building? Cool, here you go. So I think, again, I go back to this sort of the steps in quality improvement into action plan. This, you have to start the conversation. But there are programs that are recognizing they're deficient and actively making strides to fix it. We saw the same thing in some of the curriculum and things like that, just partnering with other programs to see how other people are doing it. I do want to note, because we did see, and I can't remember if it's 10 or 11 programs that had 10 complete deficiencies. So they were deficient in every category. Now, it wasn't necessarily that they were just bad at everything. It was that they were not collecting the data. And what we saw in the comments and the action plans was that there was turnover in program directors. So again, you collect this data over a year to make it. So if you came in as a new program director and your annual report was due and you didn't have any of this data, you're sort of at odds of being able to submit it. We did look at those action plans and really recognize that if you had no data, that's different than if you had a deficiency, right? We as an author team had a discussion to say, is no data, or there were some things that were a little bit difficult to really truly categorize into anything. So we said, that's not saying there's a deficiency, that's saying there's no data. So we're not gonna necessarily hold that against the program. We quantified it and said, yeah, there's 10 or 11 programs that have 10 deficiencies. All of their action plans included program director turnover, and we're going to work to start collecting the data. What would be interesting, and as we talk the next horizon, is to go to those programs and provide them the reason, like, hey, let's put you in touch with a program director who's done this before to take over, because we know program director turnover is a thing. But also to see, do we see improvement year over year? And to start tracking that to say, okay, to me, those are the programs where we have the most opportunity to set them on the right foot.
Yeah. That's what's great about a CriticCon is you got program directors all together. Here's your opportunity to talk to one another and about how they do things. I would say too, continue to monitor. I think I spent the first few years as a program director with the continue to monitor, mostly if things met a category, because it's 80% in an entire category like facilities. But if there's something within that category that drops below, and even though the whole category is okay, I would still encourage you to put comments in there to actually evaluate that. Because, like, for example, the temperature, I'm going to get on the temperature, but that was the only one in the facilities area that really dropped for us. And the whole overall category was still 80%. Well, I'll be darned. We're going to talk about facilities. Yep. And so we brought that in there. And so I would encourage people to do that. Don't settle for, well, we're okay in this whole category, we're going to ignore this one area that keeps coming up. So
the thought I have on that is, because we saw consistently, is the equipment, right? And so to start doing a little, if I were a program director and I saw a lack of, like, some themes coming out where it was equipment based, exactly, dig deeper.
Yeah.
What is it that we're missing? Is it the light bulbs are broken in the laryngoscopes, which is a pretty low hanging thing to fix?
Absolutely.
Or is it that we need brand new mannequins?
Yeah. Right?
Is it that our airway mannequins are torn apart from too many intubations? That's a lot bigger spend, but that would be another one where I agree with you. A little bit of a drilling down is probably necessary to figure out truly what's the problem here, because some of those things are probably not out of our control to fix.
Yeah,
like in a week, right? So,
did you mention this is an open access paper too?
This is an open access paper, so anybody that's following it can download it. In fact, I'm the PI on it. Download it just as many times as you want. Print it and share it all over the place. We'd be thrilled to have that that ownership, but. I think as we get to the end, one of the things the reason we did this research was so programs can utilize this data as a tool to continue growing, improving, and getting better. If you have deficiencies, take this data and say, we can get better if we have A, B, C, or D. If we have the finances, if we have the medical director involvement, this is what we need to make our program better. Use this data to your benefit to get that. And then the second point I always try to make is, this is student advocacy. The majority of completing the RAM are students. We should be looking as program directors at this data, but as a whole, this is evidence that we're looking at what students are saying about their education. And as a program director, I should absolutely be trying to improve it, but I'm listening to what my students have to say. And I think that's huge, because I don't know that we always take a pause to do that.
Great. So let me ask both of you, what can I do as a program director then to contribute to projects like this? Because we know there's more on the horizon. What can I do to contribute?
I would say doing the survey well is really important. So when you leave your comments, saying comments like, I don't think this is true, doesn't help build that up. Tell me why you don't think it's true. Put that in there. though, again, I would go back to like the majority of people are telling you this. So it's, sometimes it's a blind eye to it, may not always be the best solution, but continue to do this. This is the value in getting those surveys back. Try and get as many surveys as you can, right? Holding your advisory council members to the test of like, we're done with the meeting, do the survey so we can get it back in the real time. Same thing with students, having them do it and actually turn it in, I think is key in terms of how we continue to grow and improve so that we do have this data to benchmark it.
Yeah, Dr. Miller?
I don't have a lot to add to what was already said. The bottom line is that we need data in order to draw conclusions and share information. We're getting better, I think, at that. We're getting better at asking questions that we want to explore and examine. We want to better understand what's happening with program directors. I can tell you that one of the things that is on a lot of program director minds is the concern over who is going to be coming in to replace them. There's not a lot of people that are choosing to go into EMS paramedicine education. And so a lot of them are very concerned about who is going to step into those roles. There is a ton of opportunity to explore that in all of these particular issues, but we can only do it with people that are at the programmatic level that are willing to respond to surveys and share information about what they're doing. So it can be shared more broadly across the country.
Yeah, I do appreciate it wasn't all just about problems, because we can always just define the problems and come and commiserate, but finding solutions and helping would be great. So thank you everyone here for joining us. And for those of you online joining us, thanks for joining us today. And you can come join us next time on Friday, June 28th. But remember, there's an abstract deadline, June 30th. So don't wait that long. If you want to submit some data, maybe from your program or from some other research that you're doing. Next on Friday, June 28th, we're going to be looking at this very cool education study called A No-Brainer. Love the title. The Power of Cadaver-Based Instruction to Teach Clinical Neuroanatomy. It's a very cool study about teaching with cadavers and the impact. This is out of the American Journal of Speech and Language Pathology in November of 2023. But you can join the PCRF Journal Club earlier than that on a clinical front, and that's Monday, June 10th. Join us live each month. You can register at prehospitalcare.org. A big special thank you to Limmer Education. Remember, archived PCRF Journal Clubs can be found on our YouTube channel, too. So if you miss anything today, you can join us on YouTube. Thank you all very much for joining us, and thanks, everybody. Enjoy AccreditCon.
Yay. We hope you for coming to see us.
Thank you for
thanks, Dan. Sorry I didn't get to your.
This is the easy part.
Everybody. Hi, Katie.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Bill.
We miss you.
I know we didn't. I don't even know if my sound works. So
you guys are great. No, it's good. I heard you loud and clear.
We're having fun. We miss you.
We did get some questions.
So she's going to be Dr. Katie. You know, she's going to medical school.
Future doctor, Dr. Katie.
Did she decide where yet? That's the question.
Yes,
I know. I don't know why I can't. Oh, you muted it. Okay.
Now, where are you going to medical school?
Oh, I officially committed to UCLA, David Geffen.
UCLA.
Bruins.
Yeah, and then I'll work on fixing that medical director physician involvement stuff. Just give
thank
me
you.
Yes.
Yes, thank you. Okay,
all right, bye guys.
Because I think we're still broadcasting. Bye everybody.